Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about the 50th anniversary of To Kill a Mockingbird today. Joining us a little later, Mary McDonough Murphy. She wrote a new book about the story, about the movie. It's called Scout, Atticus, and Boo, a celebration of 50 years of To Kill a Mockingbird. And it includes reflections from Tom Brokaw and James McBride and Anna Quinlan and Oprah Winfrey and a whole slew of other celebrities. She'll be joining us in the next segment. Right now we have, by dumb luck, Artie Isaac. He's a Columbus native. He co-founded Speaker Site in 2008, Young Isaac, in 1990. And he also is a founding member and president, or founding president, of the board of trustees of Available Light Theater, which begins its production of To Kill a Mockingbird on Thursday. We'll have, of course, more details, and of course we'll have a link, as usual, on our website at wosu.org/allsides. But for now, Artie Isaac is with us today to talk about the play and his experience with it, and growing up with the book To Kill a Mockingbird. Welcome to the show, Artie.
Thank you, Ann. I'm delighted to be here. Thank you.
I mentioned it's dumb luck, which I just found out about 5 minutes ago. I thought this was well planned, that you knew it was the 50th anniversary, and aren't you smart?
No, I'm not. People have been congratulating us for our foresight in producing a stage version of To Kill a Mockingbird in the 50th anniversary of the book. And Matt Slabaugh and I have been watching the box office and reminding ourselves that we had no idea. I don't know what book is now 49 years old. I probably ought to look at that list really closely because I'm sure there's a gem. But we have it's absolutely dumb luck that the world is marketing our show for us.
So when did you realize that you had picked a winner?
Well, once we decided on it, we saw the National Endowment for the Arts had produced a small piece on it. Part of it's a Great Reads series. And, once you start doing the research that you have to do, you start finding out, oh, this is coming.
So since you didn't know it was coming, why did you decide? Why did Available Light Theater decide to stage a production of To Kill a Mockingbird?
There are two stories. One's the double secret one. I'll tell that one first. I played Felix Unger last year in The Odd Couple, and I'm not an actor. I guess I am an actor, but I'm not a trained actor. And I sort of become like my role. I'm not a method actor, but I become like my role because I can't help it. And I was becoming like Felix Unger to the point where my wife finally said, "You really are like Felix, except you don't cook or clean."
Felix is the picky one.
He's the picky one. He's the one you wouldn't want around unless he was cooking or cleaning. And I decided that I would like to play a role of a person that I want to be, that I aspire to be. And Atticus Finch comes right to the top. So I asked Matt Slabaugh, and this is the not-so-secret story. I said, I'd like to do To Kill a Mockingbird. We put an online poll up of classic plays that we might do, and that one won on our online poll. If it hadn't, I would have tried to
force.
I would have tried to throw my weight around.
It won in an online poll. Did you read any remarks from the people that voted on it? Why do you think it won?
People just love the story. It's much like Our Town. It's the kind of story that people need to return to from time to time. We see it in different ways. We see it when we read it in junior high or high school as Scout, the young girl. We see it now at my age of 50. I see it obviously as Atticus is, from his point of view. And I think that people, they just love the story. And they love the book. The book in Smithsonian Magazine just said that it was rated number two in various polls of Americans of what books should we read to be full Americans. It was number two to the Bible. So
I think it rated about the same in a similar poll in England.
Oh, great.
So it's
Number two. We should start. We can't do the whole Bible, and we're unlikely to go into the first place, but here we are.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Artie Isaac with the Available Light Theater. He's a founding president of Available Light Theater. They're staging a production of To Kill a Mockingbird this week. We'll have a link to that on WOSU.org/all sides if you want more information. Right now, I want to hear from somebody in the movie. My favorite, one of my favorite scenes is when Atticus puts Scout to bed. She asks him about his pocket watch.
Atticus, Jim says his watch is going to belong to him someday.
That's right.
What?
Well, customary for the boy to have his father's watch.
What are you going to give me?
I don't know that I have much else of value that belongs to me. But there's a pearl necklace. There's a ring that belonged to your mother. And I put them away, and they're to be yours.
Oh, my God. Is there anything like Gregory Peck?
Well, not me. That's for sure. I took off my headphones just for a moment there because I really don't want to hear Gregory Peck.
Sorry, am I messing you up?
No, he's one thing that our audience is not going to see is Gregory Peck. And I think that's intentional. We can talk about that. But that's so wonderful.
That's why I wanted to bring it up. That's not a scene in the play, but that relationship that Atticus has with his children. And you have a blog that folks can go to if they get to available Light Theater's website. And, of course, you can get to that if you go to WSU.org/all sides. But you have a blog, and you talk about Atticus quite a bit because he reminds you of somebody.
Well, he reminds me of my father. He reminds me in my best moments of myself. He reminds me in everybody's best moments of them. Atticus is he's not the alpha male. Maybe he ought to be. Maybe he is the alpha male for a civilized society. And his relationship with his children. I asked the kids in the – we were on a break in rehearsal and asked the kids, so why do you call me Atticus? We're in the South in this play in 1935. You'd call me Diddy, I guess, and Dill would call me Mr. Finch. And why do you call me Atticus? It's because he's a very modern man. And they see him as an equal, and they have mutual respect. And he's just a great father.
Now, some psychologists might see that differently, that it shows a lack of bonding, that there's not that child-father relationship. But equal isn't necessarily bad.
Well, I think that with
and
our
he
fathers,
never says a word about it. It's never raised. It's never an issue that's raised. Why do you call your dad Atticus? Why don't you call him Daddy?
You know, it's a we have to go through a transition in our lives from father as parent to father as friend. There's always the remnant of father as parent, but eventually we have to make that jump. And my father was always like Atticus. He always had a necktie on, and he always spoke thoughtfully.
He was a lawyer?
No, he wasn't. He was a stockbroker and a tennis player and a very funny, well-read, articulate fellow.
You said when you wrote about him that, on the other hand, there were people – he had clients, and they told you stories about him that you didn't know, that you learned about him through other people, like Scout and Jem learn about their father through other people.
My father was a great keeper of secrets, a great respecter of confidence. He would not betray his clients by telling me who they were. I never asked who they were, but they never came up, and it wasn't until – frankly, I was on his deathbed. He was on his deathbed. I was nearby, and he had visitors, and I saw who was coming, and I was surprised, and it was revealed to me by them that they were his clients. And then in the almost 20 years since then, 18 years since then, people have come up to me with stories saying what a great guy he was, and I'm sure this is – I hope this is true of all sons and all daughters. I hope there are moments where people come to them and say, your father was a great guy and let me tell you a story. I know that is the primary inheritance in my case.
To Kill a Mockingbird, it's I think you wrote that it is so treasured because it is beautifully written, easily savored expression of appreciation of our fathers. But people that you work with on this play had to bring other things to the table than just the fatherhood aspect of it. There were so many – their childhood, innocence, racism, segregation, intolerance, tolerance. Was that the case that people brought different things?
We all do. I think the mark of a great play is it's about everything. this is a play that's not just about fatherhood and not just about racism and the list. It's about community. It's about how to be fully human. It's about the secret to becoming human, and the secret to becoming human is being able to see other people as they really are, to be able to understand people. So yes, everyone is doing that. Everyone is either showing a blindness because Walter Cunningham is a member of a mob. He doesn't see. He's blinded along with the rest of us, as Atticus says. But the goal is for Scout to open her eyes and see Boo Radley and Tom Robinson and even her father as they really are. And that happens. That we don't get all the way to love in this play. But we certainly handle injustice, and we learn what the difference is between injustice and justice. And I think it's that human quality.
And Atticus talks about that human quality in a way when he's talking about his first gun when he was 13 or 14 years old. And he says his dad did not want him to shoot anything except tin cans in the backyard. And I think it expanded to sparrows or something like that, or blue jays maybe. But let's hear that.
But he said that sooner or later he supposed the temptation to go after birds would be too much. And that I could shoot all the blue jays I wanted if I could hit them. But to remember, it was a sin to kill a mockingbird.
Why?
Well, I reckon because mockingbirds don't do anything but make music for us to enjoy. Don't need people's gardens. Don't nest in the corn cribs. They don't do one thing but just sing their hearts out for us.
That is Gregory Peck. He is talking about why it's a sin to kill a mockingbird. It's the title of the book, To Kill a Mockingbird. That's what we're talking about right now. Joining us in a few minutes, Mary McDonough Murphy. She is a filmmaker and author, and she wrote the book Scout, Atticus, and Boo, a celebration of 50 years of To Kill a Mockingbird. Reflections from Tom Brokaw, James McBride, Anna Quinlan, Oprah Winfrey, and more. She'll be with us after this break. In the meantime, if you want to talk about To Kill a Mockingbird, do you remember the first time you ever read To Kill a Mockingbird? Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Of course, you can go to All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page and post your comment there. We'll take a break now. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
This is WOSU 820 NPR News, developed by WOSU Public Media and the Columbus Metropolitan Library. ColumbusNeighborhoods.org features more than 30 neighborhoods in and around Columbus. It allows users to tell their own stories, post their own photos and video, and contribute to the collective story of the city. To be a part of this multimedia public engagement project or to learn more, visit ColumbusNeighborhoods.org. 84 degrees currently in downtown Columbus at 11:19 this morning. Partly cloudy skies today and a high of 91. There is a chance of showers, maybe a pop-up thunderstorm this afternoon. Clouds tonight and a low of 71 degrees, still a slight chance of rain. For Thursday, mostly cloudy and a high of 87. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News. And the program continues. Thanks for joining us.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. For those of you who don't like my theme music, don't get your hopes up. That's not the new theme music. That is the theme music from To Kill a Mockingbird, the movie. And here to talk about the movie and much, much more with us is Mary McDonough Murphy, author of Scout, Atticus, and Boo. Mary, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Appreciate it. How did it occur to you? Are you one of those kind of people that look for things that are turning 49?
No, actually, the anniversary was sort of the least of my impulses when I began working on this. I had read the book for the third time. It was an adult rereading, and it made a far greater impression on me than it had in my adolescent years. I had always had a fascination with both a novel and Harper Lee, and I had spent 20 years working at 60 Minutes and Sunday Morning, a lot of different shows where I was a producer at CBS News, and I pitched it assorted times, but everyone kept saying, if we don't have Harper Lee, there's no news value. So when I sort of struck out on my own and read the book for the third time, I really began to think about the story being the novel, not Harper Lee, but the novel and the incredible trajectory the novel went on after it was published, the phenomenon it became, you know, with the Pulitzer Prize and the movie in quick succession. And so I began to think about doing a film that was the story of the novel and you know, by extension, the story of the woman who wrote the novel, to the extent that I could find more out about that. But I looked up the anniversary when I started, and so I started in 2005 thinking, well, you know, I can probably hit that, the 50th.
Well, congratulations, you hit it. In part, the book's broken up into two parts. In part one is you writing about the book in general,
right.
And the second part is the collection of essays from all the famous people. In part one of the book, you say that To Kill a Mockingbird is Harper Lee's lover, her story, her labor, that she holds its birthright, and that we, readers all, gave it life. How so? How does that work?
I just think that, I mean, of course, Harper Lee wrote an extraordinary book, and she kind of let it loose into the world. And then what happened after that is what all of us did, which is, and even in the very early going in 1960 when it first came out, readers treasure this book. And not only do they treasure it, they evangelize about it or proselytize. The early readers of To Kill a Mockingbird in 1960 just pressed it on everyone else they knew. And I think that it's a book and it's an experience, a reading experience, that we all share. And so we all gave it its long, long life and probably will continue to.
From reading the essays in the book, I started to kind of rue that I'm just 52, that I wasn't conscious and old enough to read it. I was 3 years old at the time, but I wasn't, you know, like a Tom Brokaw, who was a freshman in college reading it for the first time in 1960. I mean, wouldn't that have been amazing?
I'm sure it was. And I think it means a great deal to white Southerners such as Rick Bragg, the memoirist and journalist, and Diane McWhorter, who wrote the Pulitzer Prize-winning History of Birmingham, Alabama. I mean, I think that that a novel like this came from a white person in the deep South, in the deeply divided South. It was just an astonishing act of protest, and a beautiful one, too.
Was it James McBride, I think he's the author of The Color of Water,
yeah,
that said that no matter what, the book is dated?
Yeah, he did. I mean, and James McBride takes some issue with the portrayals of the black characters, but you know, on the other side of that, he also says Harper Lee did the best with how she was raised. So yeah, it's dated, and but it still speaks. It's interesting. Yes, there are some things that are not contemporary any longer, but it still, I believe, speaks an essential truth.
In his foreword, author Wally Lamb said that as he read the book, he wondered if each essay would bring something new, and that invariably it did bring something new. And for me, reading your book, the something new arrived in the voice. I was interested to hear. Sometimes they were saying almost the same thing, but it was who was saying that mattered.
Right.
How did? Go on.
I mean, that to me was one of the most surprising things in working on the documentary and the book. You know, I was doing interviews and as I went, and so as I headed into my 19th or 20th or 21st interview, I didn't assume as much as I wondered, could anything new be said? And invariably, somebody said something new. And whether it was, as you say, different people, whether it was Tom Brokaw talking about life in a small town, or Wally Lamb on To Kill a Mockingbird teaching him how to write a novel, Anna Quinlan about collecting insurrectionary, not girly girls in fiction, or Andrew Young about how Atticus Finch became the white judges who helped, you know, was the example of the kind of lawyer who became the white judges who helped liberate the South. I mean, every single time somebody's told me something new. You know, James McBride did question why we don't know more about the black characters, and Roseanne Cash, I thought, very beautifully extolled it, the novel as a parenting manual.
Yeah, well,
so,
what, yes,
every single time.
And it's not just about Atticus in the parenting department. It's also about Yule.
Yeah.
What not to do.
Right.
With each essay, you mention the date of birth and the birthplace of the author.
Right.
How the date of birth, basically, I think it was John Meacham was the youngest person interviewed.
I thought it was important. These were just the edited interviews. Mm-hmm. I edited down the interviews that I did with all these
Do I keep calling them essays? I'm sorry. I apologize.
And no, it's fine. And John Meacham, you know, you think of him as much older because he's so accomplished.
Right.
But when he described reading, you know, what year it was when he read it in Tennessee. But then again, also there were race issues happening in downtown at the time that he was reading it. So it resonated mightily with him.
Given that age difference, I was wondering, and obviously 50 years have passed and it sells a million copies a year, and I doubtful see anything changing in that regard, but as baby boomers, the generation of people still alive that lived through the civil rights era age, do you have a sense about how the impact of To Kill a Mockingbird might change over time when we're all dead and gone?
Well, I mean, I don't see it waning now. I followed two eighth grade classes when I was shooting the documentary. One was smack dab. One was in Hamilton, Ohio, and the other one was in a suburb of New York. And I was very interested to see what eighth graders here and now were saying about the book. And this is a book that means a lot to everyone. And it seems to mean a lot to them no matter where or when they read it. And the eighth graders, the girls didn't cling to Scout as a role model, say the way I did, because I needed a girl who wore pants and was hilarious and independent and spoke her mind. These girls that I, you know, these incredible articulate eighth grade girls, they knew they were those people. They wore pants and spoke their minds. But many of them talked about judgment and how you form judgment and conscience, and that was what the book was doing for them. It was giving them so much to chew on in that respect. And I think as long as there's race prejudice, class prejudice, misjudgments, appearances versus reality, as long as you build suspense and mystery and turn people like Boo into monsters when they turn out to be capable of incredible acts of kindness, this book is going to mean something.
My other guest, Artie Isaac, was talking about the story. It's saying it's about everything.
It is. It's about childhood. It's about race. It's about class. It's about parenthood. It's about love. It's about loneliness. And I think that really contributes to the book's enduring popularity, which is so many people relate to the novel one way or another. They don't all relate the same way, but it all strikes a chord.
I learned more than anything from reading your book about how the story really was based a lot on her life, not maybe on a particular event, but the backdrop of it is almost literal.
Well, yeah. I mean, certainly Scout is exactly the same age in the same years that Harper Lee was when Harper Lee grew up in a small town in Alabama that is built on a town square, much like the description of Macomb. So, yes, there are some parallels. But it was interesting to talk to novelists who frequently say, you know, I don't really care where it comes from. I just care, you know, what the end result was. That the autobiographical nature of things is something that readers really love to chew on, but novelists sort of dismiss it and say it doesn't matter how you got there, it's that you got to the mainland with your book.
Harper Lee is not a recluse, but she doesn't do any media interviews anymore, or, and hasn't since 1964. And yet her town where she lives has turned into kind of, probably a media circus this summer.
I'm imagining that the anniversary that July 11th and that whole weekend ought to be quite something. It's interesting to see. It's a small town. It needs revenue. It wants tourism, and so people were already making pilgrimages to mm-hmm. this town, and so then they began to get a museum together, sell a lot of souvenirs, and create pageants and shows and things that people would come to. So,
do you know if you interviewed her sister? How did you get that interview?
Well, I'm really proud of that interview because Miss Alice is extremely hard to get and has said very little. And part of it, I think, is a function of working on this for as long as I did. I wrote her some letters. I knew that she was a voracious reader, and I sent her some books to read. I also asked several other people that I had interviewed who knew her well if they would write a letter on my behalf. And so eventually I was invited to come and visit her. And I have to tell you, Miss Alice is 98 years old, and she was one of the first women in Alabama to be admitted to the bar. And she continues to practice law at Barrett, Bug & Lee, which is located in the bank building in downtown Monroeville. And when you walk in the door, there's Miss Alice in her office working on estate transfers and all her other work. I mean, she's a marvel. And I was invited to visit with her. I visited with her for quite a long time, and she shared quite a few stories about her upbringing. And then I, quietly asked if I could return with the camera crew, and she said sure. And she tutored me in Alabama history and soil and politics, and I've learned a tremendous amount from Miss Alice, and I'm very, very grateful that I've gotten to spend the time with her that I have. And her accomplishments are amazing. I mean, quite apart from the fact that she has a little sister who wrote To Kill a Mockingbird, Miss Alice herself belongs in more than just the Alabama Hall of Fame.
Harper Lee identifies more with the Boo character, Boo Radley.
Well, she said that she said it to Oprah Winfrey.
Okay.
And Oprah reported that. I mean, I think that Harper Lee is a shy person, but, she is not closeted. She's
right.
Not stuck behind the shutters of a house. I mean, just not talking to the press shouldn't be confused with being a reckless. She's led a life. I mean, she has not been Boo Radley in that respect. I think, to me, the thing that struck me the most when I heard that was what Sheriff Tate says in the book, which is you can't go shining a light on a person with shy ways. It's just not fair, and you shouldn't do it. And I think to that extent, Harper Lee, could lay claim to some boo-ness. However, I think the person that created To Kill a Mockingbird is more likely to be, oh, say, the mockingbird.
Do you have a favorite part, a favorite cut from the movie, a favorite part of the book?
I have several. I mean, I was a huge fan of Stan, like Oprah and other people. I loved stand-up, Miss Jean Louise stand-up, Your Father's Passing, really. It pretty much gets me every single time. However, I've come to really love some of the funnier passages. And I think that one of the main differences between the book and the movie, and don't get me wrong, they are both incredible masterpieces in their medium, is how hilarious Scout is as a narrator in the novel. And so I'm very partial to some of the more fun, when she says, for instance, she says Atticus was feeble, period. He was nearly 50. Or when she talks about her insufferable cousin Francis and says, talking to Francis gave me the sensation of settling slowly to the bottom of the ocean. He was the most boring child I ever met.
Her descriptions were so withering.
Yeah.
If she didn't like somebody.
The rad Hadley Place was inhabited by an unknown entity, the mere description of which of whom was enough to make us behave for days on end. Mrs. DeBose was plain hell. I mean, it just doesn't get any better than that. And I think that, you know, when you discuss To Kill a Mockingbird, as your other guest said, there is, it's about everything, and there's so much to talk about. But I think sometimes one of the things that gets overlooked is what a beautiful piece of writing it is. And it's plain in the very best sense of the word.
It's almost perfect.
Yeah. And it rewards you every time. I think that's another reason why it endures. I mean, I think this anniversary is a great time to pick this novel up again, no matter how old you are. And, I mean, I can still do it. And believe me, I've now read the book, I don't know, 17 times.
I wondered.
And I'm not tired of it. And you would think by now I would be saying, okay, enough with that. But I can still pick it up and read two pages and be, you know, completely touched or moved or laugh my head off or struck by another, you know, perfect sentence.
It's interesting you put it that way because really it started out as a collection of short stories or vignettes. Mm-hmm. When she originally wrote it and then through the editing process and so forth, it became the larger piece.
Right.
She was able to take a year off to do that.
She wasn't. I have since been able to interview the people that gave her the money.
Really?
Yeah, and they're in the documentary. The book was already going to be published by the time that happened. But, you know, we all get by with a little help from our friends, but I don't think anybody has friends like Joy and Michael Brown, who were this wonderful couple. They live in Manhattan still, and they were tremendous friends with Nell Harper Lee, and she was toiling for 10 years as an airline reservationist, and they had read her sketches and loved her writing and, you know, came into a little money that year owing to Michael Brown's work and decided that this would be a great gift for her. And, of course, it's the gift that made To Kill a Mockingbird possible.
Well, Mary McDonough Murphy, you've been a great gift to us today. Thank you for spending time with us to talk about this.
Delighted.
I appreciate it. We have to take a short break. Then we'll be back with Artie Isaac of Available Light Theater Company in a few minutes. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
This is Terry Gross, and I have about 15 seconds to explain why you should listen to Fresh Air. You should listen because, unlike this little promo, on Fresh Air we have time. Time to spend with incredibly interesting people in the arts, entertainment, and politics. Enough time that we get to know them. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes. It starts at noon. On today's edition of Fresh Air, the story of the last great chief of the Comanche Indian Nation. And then Connie Burton, who plays Tammy Taylor, the coach's wife and West Dillon's high school principal on Friday Night Lights. That discussion still ahead on Fresh Air. It begins at noon right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. Get the latest information from WOSU the way you want it, daily, biweekly, or monthly. Go to WOSU.org/email and sign up for one of our e-newsletters. 85 degrees in downtown Columbus at 11:40 this morning. Partly cloudy today, a high of 91 expected. There is a chance of showers and maybe a pop-up thunderstorm this afternoon. Clouds tonight, a low of 71 degrees, cloudy for Thursday as well, and a high of 87. Looking ahead to Friday, mostly sunny and a high of 87 degrees. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is WOSU 820, NPR News. Thanks for joining us.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher and our conversation about the book To Kill a Mockingbird. It is the 50th anniversary, and joining me again in the studio, Artie Isaac, founding president of Available Light Theater and many, many other things in the community. Too many to discuss right now because we want to get back to To Kill a Mockingbird. We'll do that another time, Artie, okay?
Okay.
You wanted to talk about, and I want you to talk about, why you're not or why you can't be Atticus Finch?
Well, I can be Atticus Finch. I can't be Gregory Peck.
Okay.
Yeah, so...
but isn't he just... Well, he defined Atticus
Yes,
Finch.
He did, and bless him for doing so. I'm grateful to him, and yet what happens is we start to delegate being Atticus Finch only to the superhuman. Gregory Peck... here's my chief thought about why I'm glad I'm not Gregory Peck, although I often wish I were. I'm glad I'm not because I think that if this play were cast, if the movie had been cast, you know, when it was cast back in the 60s, of course he was the perfect choice. But if it were cast now, it would be William Macy or someone who's a little bit more vulnerable, Tom Hanks. It would be somebody who could say, I might lose in this. There was something about Gregory Peck he couldn't lose. And I like going back to the work and taking a look at this production opening tomorrow night to get a chance to look at an Atticus that might actually have lost everything. There's a moment where Sheriff Heck Tate says, you could lose everything. Why'd you take this case? And I think Atticus, when he says, do you really think so, it's necessary for us to believe that it's true. And with Gregory Peck, he couldn't lose. He was too perfect.
You do get that feeling. And really, it's from the story. But he never actually says, we're going to lose. He says, we still have a chance. There's still an appeal.
In the play, he says, when Scout asks, are we going to win this? I have to say to Scout, no, honey. I mean, I tell her, we were licked 100 years before we started.
Good point.
So the play, you know, as the author just spoke, you know, the play has to cut so many wonderful things out. We've got to get to the heart of that we're not going to win this, and we know it.
But maybe little baby steps, as their neighbor said.
Miss Maudie says that, in fact, we are making a step towards progress.
It was interesting when I went to the dress rehearsal last night. Some things jumped out at me that they were in the book, and you know, no question about that. But in the play, that didn't resonate the same way
really?
In the book. So that was fun. That
Great.
Was, and I think that was one remark: the little baby steps. I remember reading it in the book, but it didn't rivet me. And I have to agree with Mary Murphy about that scene. It choked me up watching the play last night when they said. Stand up, your father is passing.
It's a supercharged
chills.
It's a supercharged movement. As Atticus, I know I'm not going to win this case, and yet I do hold out hope. So I don't. I guess maybe I'm just preparing Scout when I say, "No, honey, we're not going to win this." I don't want her to be destroyed by this. I think Atticus does. He's in it to win, but what defines victory is hard to claim. You know, as Miss Maudie says, we just keeping the jury out as long as we did is in some ways a victory. But yeah, when I have to walk and my friends and humans are watching me pass by, it's a very troubling moment.
The production of To Kill a Mockingbird begins tomorrow through the 27th of June at the Columbus Performing Arts Center at 549 Franklin Avenue. And you can learn more about that at HarperLeeAVLT.com. And we'll have that link on our website as well.
Thank you.
Let's read a couple emails and glad to take calls. I don't mean to hog Artie Isaac. You can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us again at allsides@wosu.org. And this email is from a listener. For better or worse, I saw the movie years before I read the book. The book just didn't have the power for me that the movie did. And like Artie, I will forever link Gregory Peck with my dad. On the other hand, my niece, 8th grade, read the book for school this past year, absolutely loved it, and then watched the movie. She didn't like the movie at all.
So listen, I respect the discrimination that this email writer has in being able to see the differences. I see the movie as, you know, you walk out of the movie, I think, and you say, they didn't take crazy chances. They didn't ruin this story. It's still, the play is that way too. I feel that when we're on stage, we are almost acting a book more than we are acting the play. Christopher Sergel's adaptation is brilliant. And it feels like the book has come to life more than we're acting a play.
More than interpreting something.
Right, I don't see it as an interpretation, except he had to figure out how to put it on the stage and put it there in 2 hours.
Allsides@wosu.org if you want to email. Yeah, Artie?
I was going to say that, but that's a great – it's almost which work hit us first. And I do believe that the play hits people last. I've met people over the past month or so who have never read the book and never seen the movie. Right? I know your eyebrows are up. It's
people of age?
Oh, yeah. People of all ages. And so I do know that there will be people in the audience for whom this is their first experience with To Kill a Mockingbird, which thrills me. It's great.
Another email from a listener. I read To Kill a Mockingbird when I was a second lieutenant in the Marines in the early 1960s. For the first time in my life, I had to work closely on a one-on-one basis with whites and blacks in the infantry platoons I led in 1962 and subsequently in various other positions. This book was very meaningful to me because it supported what I was trying to do in dealing with both white and black Marines on an equal basis. Thank you, listener, for that. And another one from Kathy. My favorite book and film. I, too, love the humor of Scout. Dil Harris, who supposedly is modeled after Truman Capote, is a wonderful addition to the summers of Jem and Scout. He and Scout both have such an adult sense of humor. As a former teacher, I remember loving the scene in which Scout is upset about the fact that she can read and her teacher isn't happy with the situation. Atticus very diplomatically tells Scout to obey her teacher, but they will still read at home as usual. This book will be in my heart forever for so many reasons. That whole, there's so much stuff in the book that I can't remember right now if it makes it into the movie, because actually I made sure I read the book again and didn't have time to watch the whole movie over again before this interview, and I instead went to see the dress rehearsal of To Kill a Mockingbird at Available Light Theater, which begins its run tomorrow at the Columbus Performing Arts Center. So,
I do think the former Marine, for whom we are thankful for his service, demonstrates that this is it's a manual for how to be human. It is if you don't know how to be human, you read To Kill a Mockingbird, and it teaches you. In a way that only a brilliant text can.
Empathy.
Yes.
Which is human.
My favorite line in the play is a very small line, and it's when Tom Robinson is on the stand and I'm his attorney, so I'm asking him questions, and he describes how he understands that Maella Yule didn't understand what he was saying, and she completely misunderstood. She thought he was a willing participant in her plan, and he said, I don't think she understood what I was saying. And I say to him, because he falls silent, I say, I understand. Go on. And to me, that is in many ways the whole message of the play. It's a line people would just think is tossed off. It's a line that says, I understand. I hear what you're saying. I understand who you are. Go on. I'd like to put that on my tombstone.
I want to know more.
I understand, and let's go on. Keep going. Keep telling me.
614-292-8513, email allsides@wosu.org. This is from Johnny on Facebook. Great book, obviously, and great film with one of the most lyrical opening title sequences ever. It is beautiful. When they're opening up the box.
Oh, yeah, yeah,
and
yeah.
The music is incredible. When I was listening to the music again, we've been playing the theme after each break. It starts out so soft, and it builds, and it never gets overwhelming or loud by any means, but it's so beautiful.
You know, she wrote a perfect book, and any 13-year-old who reads this book can tell you so. It is apparent that the structure and the build is marvelous.
Let's listen to a portion of the famous speech. Just to freak Artie out.
Yeah, I have to tell you, mentions of the movie, they fall on me. I don't understand it because the moment I thought of doing this, I, of course, did not get the movie because that would be just too troubling. And so since I hadn't seen it, it's been a while. But I can take it. Go ahead.
Okay, all right. It's this from Atticus's closing argument in the courtroom of trying to save the life of Tom Robinson.
And so, a quiet, humble, respectable Negro who has had the unmitigated temerity to feel sorry for a white woman has had to put his word against two white peoples. The defendant is not guilty, but somebody in this courtroom is. In the name of God, do your duty.
Oh, my.
In the name of God, believe Tom Robinson.
Okay. Artie Isaac's freaking out.
Oh, my. Unmitigated temerity to feel sorry for a white woman. It's very different than I know how to do, and it's very different than I would do. And I think that's the beauty of her text, is that there are lots of ways to be Atticus. And, wasn't that beautiful?
Yeah, he has a beautiful voice. No question about it. That there's so many spots that you could pick. You could almost riff right through that book and pick any page.
Right.
And Mary McDonough Murphy was mentioning how you can just kind of pick up the book, open a page, and read a funny section or read something moving, and it's that kind of a book.
It is, absolutely.
We can play that? Okay. Without Peck.
You got a Peck-free version here?
Okay. We have another scene where a sheriff is talking to Atticus. So this is not Atticus speaking. He's talking about Bob Ewell's death while Scout and Arthur Boo Radley sit nearby in the
porch. The sheriff's a really wise fellow.
Oh, the sheriff's a great
character. He's very wise in a very practical way. Atticus is wise in a philosophical and universalist way, but the sheriff knows people.
I thought well cast in the play as well.
Oh, yeah. Tim Dougherty's a great, great actor.
To my way of thinking, taking one man who's done you and this town a big service and dragging him with his shy ways into the limelight, to me, that's a sin. I may not be much, Mr. Finch, but I'm still sheriff of Macomb County. And Bob Ewell fell on his knife.
You know, this is a moment where Atticus is about to make the big mistake. He's about to stand on principle, which is a great thing to do, but there is a higher mitzvah, a higher important act, and that is to stand for a human. And and the sheriff is saying, "I hate arguing with you when you're like this, Mr. Finch." And what he's meaning is, you're not seeing people at this point. You're just seeing what right and wrong, and people mess that up all the time.
Again, getting back to the human.
Yeah.
Human of it all, not the law, but the humans behind the law and the humans behind the rules and the regulations.
You know, having your children attacked is enough to make you forget humanity. You become very defensive and confused. And this is Atticus confused. And the sheriff is not confused. The sheriff knows law enforcement and he sees people at their best and worst.
The language in the book, the movie, the play bothers some people because they still use the N-word.
Oh, yeah.
How did you talk about that, especially with the kids and the child actors in the play?
You know, it's interesting. Ian Short, our very wonderful director, he lets the text speak for itself. He never gives you a line read. He never tells you this is how you're supposed to say it or what it's supposed to mean. I will say that it was very unsettling in the very first reading where we all sat around a table and read it. This word, the N-word, that our generation doesn't like to speak for obvious good reasons, seems to have lost so much power in popular culture because of its overuse in so many forms. And yet, I will say this, that to read the word in the book is unsettling. To hear it shouted across the stage at a human, at a friend, at a co-actor, at a person is really troubling. And so we've never explained it. I'll tell you, though, the strangest moment was when one of the actors was asked about his motivation. And in his explanation, not part of the script, in his explanation, he used the word in a very strong way. And we all thought, ooh, don't know that we're allowed to do that. It really, you know, nobody said that, but it was chilling.
Uncomfortable.
Well, I feel for the actors that have to stand up, point fingers, and scream that word. That is not who these people are, and it's hard.
As an actor, what would you do in that moment? Would you channel all the anger and this feeling of frustration about everything that has to do with race and racism and segregation and everything and the whole history of the United States into that word? How would you say it with the force?
The brilliance of Harper Lee and this adaptation, this play from our first reading acts itself. What we do is, you know, we can amplify it. We can make a lot of great choices or, you know, choices you might question. That's it. the words act themselves, and it's not hard to do this play really, really well without that kind of thinking. Now, the actors have all internalized a lot of it, and so they have done just as you've suggested. But I'll say that it's hard. It would be hard to do this play badly.
Is there any temptation as an actor, as a theater company, to restage it in another era?
We talked about
that. The 1960s, for instance.
One of our patrons, former board member Roy Gottlieb, very brilliant fellow, a dentist, man of culture here in town. He suggested at one point, why not make the judge black and Tom Robinson Hispanic? Why not take this as you're suggesting? Because there's a problem with this play. There's a problem with the audience. There's a problem with us. The problem is that it's real easy to say, oh, this is a Southern thing. And we think about the South and we think of key lime pie and mint juleps and Bob Yule. And that's letting ourselves off a little easy up here in the North where we're so sophisticated. You know what? We got the same problems. These are universal. So we did think about how can we bring this up to date? And we thought about the work. It would cause a total rewrite. And to do that, we would be leaving behind a work that is already perfect. We could have just had us in contemporary clothes. I will say that people who want to hear the Deep South and Alabama in our dialect, they might draw conclusions about how we're not all the way there. I'm not. Some of the actors are. You know, this isn't about the South.
You said that in your blog that the play has changed you and that's what you wanted. That's why you wanted to do it, that you're an actor in search of epiphany. How did it change you?
Well, acting in general teaches us how to listen more than it teaches us how to talk and strut around and wave our arms. This play has taught me how to listen and how to, in listening, really try to understand who I'm talking to, who's talking to me. This idea of I understand, go on, as Atticus says to Tom Robinson on the stand, I understand, go on. I've been playing my life a lot more about around that, seeking to understand first and then seeking to be understood. I lived my whole life before this play or, you know, too much of my life trying to be understood. This play teaches us to try to understand first. And it definitely, it's done a number on me. I'm so grateful.
Well, I'm grateful for you to join us today when you must be so busy, Artie Isaac.
Well, I've learned most of my lines and we are ready. You know, we are a day away from being ready.
Ready for what, you might ask? It's a production by the Available Light Theater of To Kill a Mockingbird. It's at the Columbus Performing Arts Center, June 24th through the 27th. That's at 549 Franklin Avenue, and you can learn more about that. Go to WOSU.org/allsides. We'll have a link for that where you can learn more about it. Once again, Artie, thanks so much, and have a wonderful run.
If tickets are available at the door, there will be available for the price of Pay What You Want, because we believe everyone should get some theater.
The Pay What You Want program, yes. You can learn more about that on the website as well. I saw that. Thanks again. And
thank you, Ann, for what you're doing for our town.
This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820. This is listener-supported WOSU and WOSU HD 820 Columbus and streaming on the web at WOSU.org, WOSU 820, NPR News.